This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashran Johan. My guest on today's show is Ian Yee, one of the most prominent investigative journalists in Malaysia today. He was one of the pioneers of popular impact journalism channel Rage and has recently founded a new investigative journalism platform, The Fault. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking a little bit about your new project, The Fault, which is pioneered by the team behind Rage. How did The Fault come about?
I actually joined as a junior journalist at The Rage, but we certainly oversaw that transition from it being kind of like a college campus type of vibe into an investigative unit. So that same team, we decided to start something more independent because I think that's something that's really lacking, not just in Malaysia, but in Southeast Asia in general, where you don't have a lot of really strong, independent investigative teams. You know, I know, you know, you've got some great people like Rappler or Tempo in Indonesia, but we thought maybe we want to bring our brand, you know, the kind of impact-driven investigative journalism that we do, you know, to a broader audience, and to kind of do it in a more independent manner. It's not to, you know, not to put anyone else down, but, you know, it's actually, when it comes to investigative journalism, it's just much easier to do it as an independent social enterprise where you don't have kind of advertising pressure and stuff like that. So that's why we founded The Fault.
Yeah. Right. And what sort of impact are you hoping The Fault would make?
I hope that we'll be able to show people, not just in Malaysia, but again in Southeast Asia, that investigative journalism is incredibly important to any society. Like, if you, I always feel it's one of like the best barometers of, you know, social justice or you know, how well a democracy is thriving in any society, is if you have really, really good investigative journalism, that means things are going well. Because that means that there is a very strong commitment, there's a very strong ecosystem that holds power to account. So whether that power is, you know, government, or whether it's billionaires or whatever it is, you know, people who have any form of power that can be abused, you need to have that ecosystem of investigative journalists that are holding them to account. So ultimately, what I want to do with Forf, what my team and I hope to do as the Forf, is to kind of show people again, you know, I think a lot of people have forgotten what really good investigative journalism can do. Not that we do really good investigative journalism, you know, it's just, we want to be able to facilitate that. We want to be able to fund, you know, some investigative projects as well. And one thing I know is my team, they have really, really great skills in terms, not just in terms of investigative work, but also in terms of content production, in terms of the documentaries, the multimedia work they've done in the past. It's just really, really great. So we want to be able to bring that, you know, to the broader region and collaborate with people across, you know, across borders to do more of these projects that have a positive impact on society.
Well, I must say, you guys do fantastic investigative journalism work.
Thanks.
And I noticed that y'all are working together with this NGO called Pile Peluang, which is advocating for the end of the war on drugs and highlighting the consequences of the war on drugs. Tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing with Pile Peluang.
Pile Peluang is actually a part of this broader coalition, which is trying to get, it's what they call decarceration, which means we're trying to get minor offenders, especially in Malaysia, where like 60% of prison inmates are actually there for non-violent or minor drug offenses. So we're trying to decarcerate these people and remove them from the criminal, from the prison system, because it's been proven that prison actually doesn't work in terms of rehabilitating, you know, non-violent drug offenders. In fact, it makes things worse. Studies throughout history have shown if you take someone who has an issue with substance abuse or was just trying recreational drugs for the first time, and if you put them in prison, chances are they will go further and further into crime. They'll go further and deeper into drug use because the prison system just doesn't work that way. So you need to give them alternative sentencing in terms of counseling, in terms of therapy for addiction and stuff like that. So that's what that coalition has been pushing for, you know, with some really great organizations. Pile Peluang is one of them. You've got Swaram and Churia. So they're doing great work. Please go check that out. This agency approached us, asked if we want to be part of, you know, an effort to highlight this coalition's work? And we said, yeah, we can do a documentary like we always do. And thankfully, the response has been good in a way. Lots of people have watched, I think on Twitter, it has like a couple hundred thousand views already. But the problem is the reaction has been mixed, and we kind of expected that as well. A lot of people still feel these are drug addicts. Well, you know, what do you mean? They're people with substance abuse disorder. You know, they're just drug addicts.
Right.
And we should just throw them all in prison. And we start that conversation as we always do, you know, trying to just tell them what the facts are. Prison doesn't work. These people have a disorder. These people they need treatment and help, you know, instead of incarcerating them. So that's the project.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about your personal journey a little bit. When did your journey in journalism begin?
It was actually all by accident, really.
Okay.
I come from a pretty poor family. My family, we grew up in Jinjiang, which is, those people who are from KL will know, is a new village, a bit of a ghetto. So it was just all by accident. That was the only course that we could afford at Tao College, which is, you know, which is great because Tao College gives this really affordable college education to people like me and people from my family. So mass communications was pretty cheap. I fancied myself a bit of a writer, so I signed up for journalism. And that's how it all started, actually. I never thought I would end up in like proper news reporting or let alone investigative reporting. But then I had two really great editors who always pushed me. You know, they said, you know, now we have the privilege of, you know, being part of a newspaper that reaches a million people every day. What are we going to do with it? Are we just going to write fluff pieces, or are we going to make a difference? And then when we started to pivot towards investigative journalism, we brought on this producer, investigative producer. His name is Elroy. He doesn't like being mentioned very much. He hates the limelight. He just likes to do his investigative work. So once in a while, we try to mention his name in harsh tones. But he also pushed us to keep investigating, to be brave, to be bold, to be the ones that start, you know, that make that change. So that's how we got here today, from necessity all the way to, you know, being fully invested in investigative work.
That's very interesting, because this is, you know, you're saying that there wasn't necessarily a sort of specific, you know, issue or moment in your life that made you go, you know, okay, I want to be an investigative journalist. It's more like circumstances. You accidentally fell into it. What has been the experience so far then?
I can't really remember how most of it felt, because it was just such a wild ride, you know. Rage, we started out with kind of like, there was like zero frame of reference, right? Because investigative journalism in Malaysia was at a bad place because of all various factors. You know, media companies were struggling. It feels like there was no appetite from the Malaysian public for investigative work. And unfortunately, investigative journalists, they are the first ones to go, you know, whenever a newsroom is struggling, because it's resource heavy. People don't always appreciate the kind of work that they do. So they are the ones that have to be like redesignated to other forms of news. So when we first started out, it was nerve-wracking, but at the same time, very, very exciting, because I think kind of like there was no pressure. We weren't being compared to anybody else, so we could just produce what we wanted to produce. And if it didn't work out, you know, things weren't working out that well at Ridge anyway. You know, we were struggling. There were all these news sites, these news aggregator sites that were coming out that were really disrupting the industry. They were copying and pasting our stories like crazy. So it was not a good time for us anyway. So when we kind of stumbled into this formula of investigative and impact-driven journalism, I think, it just took off. It was just such a crazy ride. The first thing we did on Orang Asli, the deaths of Orang Asli children in the Belum Temenggor. There's a state park there. When we first released that just, you know, that went viral. And then after that, we did the Predator My Phone investigation on child sexual crimes, and that went viral. So it just never stopped from there. It was just a wild ride. And all the way until now, we are with The Fourth, and we are not really fully launched yet. We haven't started doing all the original content yet. We're supposed to try to figure out the business side of things. We haven't really had any chance to catch our breath at all. So I really can't tell you how I feel right now or how this has felt. But what I can say is that if you take a chance on these things, you know, as like for us, we had a great idea. We had our ideals. Some people say we were maybe too idealistic, but we just went for it. You know, we felt like it was the right thing to do. And if it fails, it fails, you know.
Right.
Not many people have the privilege or the luxury to say that if it fails, it fails. But thankfully we did, and it didn't fail. You know, we put our hearts and souls into it and it worked out. And hopefully it will continue working out now that we're with the fourth as well.
What has been your proudest piece of investigative journalism to date?
It's really hard to choose, to be honest, because my team has done such great work. And I haven't been that involved in all of them. But I think probably the first one, I still feel a lot of, maybe it's nostalgia, but I still am quite proud of that. We were starting from zero, you know, like Rage was not in a good place. Like I was saying earlier, the industry was in the shambles. And our team decided, you know what, we're going to take this trip to the Orang Asli village. It was risky. You know, there was no medical assistance nearby, which was kind of the problem we were investigating in the first place. But my team were so brave. They went in, they got the story out there. And that was kind of like our first proof of concept that good investigative journalism doesn't just expose problems, you know, it can bring solutions, it can bring a positive impact. And that kind of set the tone for the rest of our work, you know, whether it was the predator in my phone investigations, which most people know, student trafficked, where we uncovered and kind of shut down a literal human trafficking network.
Tell me a little bit about that, because you brought it up a couple of times, and that honestly has been, I think it could, perhaps was the big break, quote unquote, for Rage at the time, right? The predator in my phone investigation that y'all did, like you said, you know, 6 months undercover, exposing child sexual predators. Talk to me about that, like the entire sort of process. Was it an incredibly uncomfortable experience? What did y'all have to do to investigate this whole issue?
Yeah, it was really difficult. It was really, really difficult mentally, physically, emotionally. It was tough for 6 months to look at all this, and in many ways, itching to let the story, to put the story out there, you know. But we had to be strategic. That's kind of one of the conundrums that you have, right, as a journalist sometimes. Especially as an investigative journalist, you know the issue, and yet you know you have to get to the bottom of it before the story comes out. If not, you're just going to ruin, you know, a lot of other efforts that are being taken, like what the police are doing in terms of their investigation, what civil society is doing in terms of their advocacy, and trying to see the bigger picture of how we solve the problem versus just trying to get a scoop out there. You know, as a journalist, I can write a story, put it on the front page, my byline is there, I feel great. Mm-hmm. But does it really help make a difference? And that's where our impact, you know, model comes in. It was very, very difficult. There were many, many sleepless nights. And again, there was no one we could call to for advice. You know, there weren't that many other investigative journalists around. We created fake accounts and we posed as underage children. We didn't want to do the other way around where we posed as predators, right? Because that would mean we would be eliciting some form of contact with the children, which we just didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. And we know after the first episode came out as well, there were some YouTubers who approached us and said, you know, why don't we do a viral series? You know, we're going to pretend to be predators and see if the children respond. And we're like, no, that's not the way we do things, right? So, this is going to go viral. This is going to be crazy. And I think one agency kind of proposed something like that as well, like one creative agency. And we just said, no, that just ethically, that just doesn't go right. But so we kind of created accounts where we mentioned that the owner of this account is 15 or 14 years old, and we see where those conversations lead. And invariably and unfortunately, they always lead towards something that's sexual. So that happened no matter how many times we tried it. So we created accounts on different messaging platforms, whether it's Facebook Messenger, WeChat, or KakaoTalk, BeTalk, whatever it is. We would always get that same result. And we even tried it in different parts of the country. So when we had some work in Penang, we would try it there. We had some work in Johor, we tried it there as well, and it was always the same. So And then after that, what you do is you would have to maintain those conversations for maybe several weeks, which is, again, very difficult for the journalists.
Right.
Because they always play the long game, these sexual predators, you know, they're smart. They try to desensitize the child towards conversations about sex. And then eventually, by the time you meet, they ask you to meet up with them, you kind of feel like you owe it to them, I guess, in a way. It's weird psychological power play going on. So we would maintain those conversations as long as we can without doing, yeah, you know, and with a whole lot of guidelines, right, that mm-hmm. we set up around it, until finally those that are will ask us to meet up, or some they would just keep that exploitation online where they would ask for video chats or explicit videos or requests for sexual imagery. Yeah, so that was a difficult process. Yeah,
certainly. On the show with me today is Ian Yee, investigative journalist and founder of The Fort. After the break, I ask him about some of the biggest lessons he's learned in his years in journalism. We'll be back with more on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Darshan Johan, and my guest on today's episode is Ian Yee, investigative journalist and founder of The Fort. So, Ian, investigative journalism, right? Apart from being very uncomfortable, at least from the outside, it also seems like it can be really scary work sometimes. You know, you're going undercover, you know, as children with child sex predators, like you brought up before the break. Sometimes, you know, investigative journalists have to go into drug rings, you know, prisons and all sorts of various instances and situations like these. Has it ever been scary for you?
Yes. I think it's a risk that is inherent in all investigative work. You can't, it's essentially impossible to do investigative journalism without risk. All we can do is to mitigate that risk. So in the early days, we used to have some very basic forms of risk assessment. But as we grew larger, we started to take on more complex investigations. That's when we got some, you know, advice from others. Especially regionally, you know, started making friends in the region. People started to take notice of our work, and we could go to them for some advice. So by now, we take risk assessment very, very seriously. And these risks are, you know, they come from the likeliest of places. You know, in fact, probably the biggest risk that people always assume that it's going to be physical risk, that it's going to be physical harm. But legal threats are just as bad. You know, political threats as well. Cyber threats, you know, so these are all things that we have to mitigate against. It is, especially for example, when we take on certain things that are involved with, you know, the elements of organized crime, whether it was the thing we did on drug mules,
right,
you know, being trafficked into Hong Kong and being stuck in prisons there, or, you know, the human trafficking thing that Elroy did was, you know, was an amazing piece. That too, there was quite a huge element of risk, knowing that there's millions of dollars involved. But I think it comes back to, you know, when we were doing Predator on my phone, and that's when a lot of people, Malaysians, finally sat up and realized, oh, this is what investigative journalism can be, right? But they were also saying, so clearly there's an element of risk, of danger, and a lot of people asked us whether we were worried or whether we were afraid. And our response at the time was that, These people are doing something that's clearly wrong, right? And somehow in Malaysia, we've created this culture where why is the majority of us that aren't doing anything wrong? You know, why are we afraid of that minority?
Right.
And so we made it a point everywhere where we said, like, we shouldn't be the ones afraid. All of you, you know, whenever we were invited to do talks or whatever with students, we'll say, oh, we shouldn't be the ones that are afraid. They are the ones that need to be afraid of us. We need to work together. We need to take a whole society approach with police, with politicians, with civil society, with the general public. And we need to make them afraid of us, not the other way around. So I think that's kind of been the ethos my team has continued operating on, that if it just takes someone to take that first step. And in Malaysia, very often in civil society, lots of great NGOs are doing great work. To take that first step and say, we are going to rally people together to go against this minority that's using their power to cause harm to other people. We shouldn't be afraid of them anymore. They should be afraid of us. And the only way we're going to make them afraid of us is if we all really band together and you know, take a really concerted effort to call it out and to find solutions.
You have to go through a lot of discomfort. I'm guessing, you know, mental health among you, your colleagues and all, there will be times where it gets really difficult, scary, like you mentioned, especially dealing with organized crimes, the big shots, politicians and whatnot, legal threats, cyber threats. What has kept you going all these years?
I don't know, to be honest. I think it's just, once you've heard some of these stories, you know, you can't unhear them. You know, like for me, it was speaking to, for example, a victim of human trafficking. And I've told this story quite a few times, where he's been separated from his family for 4 years. He thought he was coming to Malaysia to get a degree, but he got shipped off to a construction site and is forced to work there for 4 years. You know, and his family had invested their entire savings into him because he was the smart one in a way. You know, he was good at studies, so that he could get a college degree in Malaysia. He could change the family fortune. So they sold everything, paid for him. And he's stuck in the construction site here, and he hasn't had the heart to tell his family back home what's going on. Right? So to them, he's still doing his degree, when in fact, he's lost all the money, he's gone, and he's just trying to repay that bondage that he's in now to try to find a way to go back to Bangladesh to finally see his parents again. So when you hear stories like that, you're kind of like, can you really walk away? Can you really turn away from this? And so that's kind of how we kept going. You know, that people bring more stories to us. People tell us, oh, no, these group of people are facing this form of oppression. These people are being, you know, hurt in this, harmed in this or that way. You kind of just want to do whatever you can. And thankfully for me, I have a really, really great team. People like, oh, right, and you know, Sean and some of, and, you know, the earlier Rage people, I see in them the talent and the ability to make a difference and to help these people. So why not? So my role is easy. I just manage them. I keep them, you know, organized. I keep them going. And hopefully by the end of all these projects we do, we can make just a tiny bit of a difference in Malaysia.
Definitely. You know, I'm very curious because journalism, like you said earlier, right, is something you stumbled into. It wasn't like this childhood passion or you know, things like that. You stumbled into it. It was one of the cheaper courses to do. And then you got into investigative journalism. Did you have to have difficult conversations with your parents? Were they ever worried? Did they, you know, think you're absolutely crazy because you come from an Asian family, humble beginnings, you know, and then now you're saying you're going to go into drug rings and take on, you know, investigate organized crime and human trafficking and all these sorts of things. What was your parents' reaction or your family's reaction when they discovered that this is the path that you were going to tread?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I come from a family that, you know, has always placed a lot of importance in helping others. So both my parents are Christian ministers, and they've done a lot of work, very, very selfless work for the community. Like I mentioned, we're from Xinjiang, right? So it's a very poor community,
right?
Lots of social issues. And my parents have dedicated their lives to helping people there, regardless of religion, you know? So I guess in a way, they probably have themselves to blame if they feel, you know, worried about it now. But yeah, they do ask, like, you know, is everything, once in a while they'll ask, is everything okay? And we do come from that kind of Asian background where, you know, if there's a problem, you know, I'll tell you. If not, you know, everything's fine. but they've been very, very supportive. I think in some cases they realize that we're kind of following in their footsteps as well.
What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned in your years of journalism?
Empathy is the solution to so many of the world's problems today. As journalists, we get to practice empathy every day, right? When we go out, when we do interviews, we're practicing active listening and all these, you know, kind of like buzzwords that are going around now, right? In terms of empathetic leadership.
Right.
So we do that every single day. And it's such a privilege. We're paid to go out and empathize with people, really listen to their stories, really understand them and hear their truths and to be able to tell it to the world. So, and I think really if the world had a bit more empathy, if our leaders had more empathy, the world would be such a much more better place. So when we try to explain to young people what an empathetic leader is, it's someone who listens first, who understands. Empathy means putting yourselves in the shoes of somebody else. So an empathetic leader would look at the people that he or she or they are leading and try to understand how they feel, understand what they're thinking, and lead based on that. And that is actually the opposite of a dictator, right? So a dictator is someone who says, I don't care how you feel about this, you're just going to do what I say.
Right.
So that's why empathetic leadership is so important, right? You don't want more and more people ending up being dictators, and this applies not just in politics, but also in terms of the corporate world, in terms of even, you know, the kind of organized crime that we look at. A lot of the people, we always ask ourselves sometimes, why are these people doing this? Why is this drug mule recruiter doing this? He knows that he's potentially sending some of these people to their deaths. Like when sending Malaysians to countries like China, if you're caught, it's a death penalty.
Right.
Or in Singapore, we're seeing it right now. Mm-hmm. So what possesses someone to do that? And through my work as a journalist, I realized they lost their sense of empathy somewhere along the way. Whether it's the education system, whether it is abuse at home, something has removed that sense of empathy to the point where I don't care what other people feel anymore. I'm going to do whatever I want for me. And that's where, you know, that's why I feel, and that's why I run this program with UNICEF on empathetic leadership. And hopefully through the work that we do as well with the fourth, again, coming back to letting these values shine through our work, you know, aside from the issue that we're investigating, that value of empathy is very important. That value of really having a proper conversation, a proper interview with someone where you're asking about who they are, where they're from, and really listening. Hopefully that value shines through as well in the work that we continue to do at the Force.
I want to talk to you a little bit, Ian, about the state of journalism in the world today. During the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize award to Maria Ressa, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee said that, and I quote, they are representative for all journalists in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions. Do you agree with this? Is media freedom under threat across the globe?
Yes, definitely. And fun fact, I was actually with Maria when...
Right, yes, you were.
When the announcement was made, which was like the most insane thing, because I was moderating a town hall on press freedom,
mm-hmm.
So appropriate, about press freedom, and especially from a Southeast Asian perspective. So we were talking, and suddenly she gets a call, you know, while we were on Zoom chatting, and she gets a call, she goes on mute for a while, and that's when we realized, oh my God, the tweet came out, we're like, she's just won the Nobel Peace
Right.
Prize. And I think it was such a great statement to the world. It's such an amazing, amazing thing to happen because it's trying to spotlight, like Maria herself said, it's trying to spotlight on the work that so many other journalists are doing. And we talk about, you know, safety, and we talk about us here in Malaysia being worried about threats. What about journalists in Indonesia or in the Philippines where they actually get killed?
Right.
For standing up for their community, for defending, you know, for defending truth and defending justice in their community, they lose their lives, they get shot. And imagine the impact of that to their families and to their communities. It is devastating. And so we have to remember that. And I think Maria winning that award is just, it's for all of those journalists out there and across the world, in South America. And I know there are some on the front lines now in Ukraine today. All power to them. And the great thing, I think, is Maria was so quick, you know, in that conversation that we had, in that Zoom call. She immediately, her first instinct was to say, this is not about me. This is about all of us. She's just one representative. She's a high-profile person. And she got that award, but it really is for every journalist out there who is being oppressed, who is under threat. And I hope people don't forget this moment and people start appreciating the work of journalists and start supporting the work of journalists.
You know, you brought up something very interesting, and that is, you know, about you hope that more people would understand and support journalism. We live in a time where, you know, WhatsApp, in a time of WhatsApp chain messages, rampant fake news, algorithms creating echo chambers, and people unwilling to fork out money to subscribe to quality content behind a paywall. I mean, at the very least, you know, during our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, people would be willing to fork out R1.50 every single day to buy a newspaper. A lot of people are not willing to do that. Do you sort of have sort of existential thoughts about what all this could, what all of this could lead to or has already led to?
I think social media in particular has led to this really, really dangerous, toxic environment where truth doesn't matter anymore, right? Where you're surrounded by these echo chambers. Enough has been said about that. But I think what I really want to highlight is that role of the gatekeeper of this, of information and truth, right? Nobody's perfect, but traditionally, you know, newspaper editors, you know, their livelihoods depended on this, right? That's their job, and you know, they have standards and values and principles in place to ensure that they are delivering the truth to people as best as they can, as accurately, as objectively, as fairly as they can. So that's the role of the editor in being that gatekeeper. What is happening now is that social media has like blown things wide open, and to the point where now, who is the gatekeeper of truth and information? It is the social media algorithm.
Right.
And who owns that algorithm? Billionaire tech moguls somewhere who have their own interests, right? So is that really somebody you want to be your gatekeeper of information? Look at the way the world is right now. Is, you know, are we on a positive trajectory? And I'm part of the Obama leadership program. And Obama, when he was here, when former President Barack Obama was in KL, he was saying that, you know, that, and he said this quite a few times over the years, that human progress, like if you look over, like in the broad history, things have gone, you know, have progressed.
Right.
The world is in general a better place than it was 50, 100, 200 years ago.
Right.
It's hard to see that when it comes to media right now.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like we've taken a huge nosedive, right? Where now truth just doesn't matter anymore. And that's something that we all need to be concerned about. Where is the state of truth and you know, and information in the world today? Because it's going to have an impact on wider human development, the wider development of the world that we live in. Because then you see things like, for example, like just a small thing, like just vaccines, like information on vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
It's so quickly hijacked in a social media environment, right? With the algorithm that kind of rewards fake news.
That's right.
Right. There's a study that's been well quoted that fake news spreads 6 times faster than real news, because the algorithm rewards this type of, oh, I found something new. I found something you don't know about, and I'm going to tell the world about. I'm so different. I'm so contrarian,
right.
And everybody, you know, gets sucked into that. So that has real world implications. What happens on that algorithm in that social media space is going to have very real, very, very real implications in the real world. And the solution to this is this quote that I've heard, and it's been going around. I don't know who to attribute it to anymore, but the solution to fake news, the solution to bad journalism is more good journalism.
Hmm.
And that's what we believe at The Fourth, right? We can't go around fact-checking everyone. You know, we can't, that's a losing battle,
right?
It's kind of like first aid, it's just putting a band-aid on a piece of fake news and just say, oh, I've checked it, it's not real. No, we have to keep doing better journalism. We have to keep doing good journalism and reminding the people what good journalism looks like and how it can help them and how it has a positive impact on society. So that's what we want to do. It's important to fact check. Sometimes it's important to correct misinformation and disinformation. But equally more important is investing more time into really, really good, high-quality journalism, into the investigative journalism that is so often the first to go when money runs out.
Right.
We need to uphold that. And that's the best way for people to get out of that state where they keep falling for all these tiny bits of fake news, but they realize that there's this high quality reporting that gives me clarity, that adds value to my life, that helps make my world a better place. I will support that.
Absolutely. Ian, it's been really lovely talking to you. Before we wrap this conversation up, final thoughts or a final message, why is journalism important?
I think to understand how important journalism is to society, we have to go back to, you know, that traditional role that the media is supposed to play. The media is called the fourth estate, right? So in most societies, even for the past until now, there are three powers in society, right? Even now you have, in most democratic societies, you have the executive branch, you have the legislature, you have the judiciary, and they hold so much power over society. So who's going to hold them accountable if they don't wield that power appropriately? But that's where the media comes in, the fourth estate, the fourth power. And I think that's why it's so important for us to remember that role of, you know, as journalists, we need to remind ourselves as well constantly that we are the fourth power, working on behalf of the people to hold those people in power accountable. Whether they are politicians, whether they are wealthy business people, whether even people in civil society, if they're not, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. That is our role. If we don't have that, just imagine a world where all these power structures, whether it's government, whether it's, you know, rich business interests and all that, where there's just zero accountability. Mm-hmm. Imagine that world where your big tech companies, zero accountability. What could possibly go wrong? Everything could go wrong.
Right.
Eventually, that power, that money, you know, corruption is going to happen. Abuse of power is going to happen. Oppression is going to happen. And we're seeing that in play around the world throughout human history. And that's why the role of media and journalism is so important. Investigative journalism, we need to be there on the front lines and defending truth and justice, playing our role as the fourth estate and holding power accountable. So yeah, hopefully we get to keep doing it. And hopefully, you know, people will support us in doing it as well. It might be a bit self-serving, but, you know, we do want to be public funded. We do want to make sure that the readers are the ones that are, you know, subscribing and funding our operations. If you can, go check out the FARF and show us a bit of love.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Ian.
Thank you.
That was Ian Yee. He's an investigative journalist and the founder of The Fourth. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.